Tulla is an expert in the field of fuel cells, batteries and new solutions for energy transformation at the world-famous MIT. I could ask him some questions, starting with, why did you choose to visit the Helmholtz Zentrum, Berlin?
Well, one of my areas of interest is the field of energy conversion, particularly one based on renewable energy. And it turns out that at this institution, there's now a very, very highly regarded group working on what's called solar fuels. So actually, I've known Professor van der Kroll for some time. I was fortunate enough to have him visit at MIT as a postdoctoral researcher about a dozen years ago. Subsequent to that time, you know, we continued discussions and activities, but on a low scale when he returned to Delft. Actually, just in the last year or so, we discovered now a strong common interest in this area of photo-assisted generation of fuels, for example, by the splitting of water. So this was kind of a perfect opportunity to reconnect and to follow through on some ideas we've been thinking about.
And Professor van der Kroll is now, he's starting to build up this institute. He will increase his staff. And do you have any good ideas for him, which you can give him?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's something that he was also aware of and why he was very pleased to have me come here. And that is, in order to really make progress in this field, we have to examine new materials. These materials can be fairly complex. A lot of the work to date has been more on the basis of trial and error, phenomenological studies, and we both believe that it's really an opportune time now to delve into these materials in a deeper fashion, really to understand what are the limiting processes which are now limiting, for example, both the efficiency and the stability of these materials. And one of the areas which I have a good deal of expertise in is understanding and evaluating and describing the defect structure of these materials. So we're already from the preliminary work we've been doing, we're both very excited about some trends that we're seeing, and we are convinced that this is going to end up with some very interesting and attractive results.
But your devices are very, very small, 1 square millimeter or something like this, isn't it?
Or 1 square centimeter, probably.
Okay. Yeah. So what are the chances to make them big?
Yeah. So it turns out that it's not just ourselves, but many people have fallen in love, so to speak, with this material called hematite. And hematite is really just iron oxide or rust. Mm-hmm. So it is, as you can imagine, an extremely inexpensive material. It's already in large amounts distributed in the Earth's crust. It's non-toxic. So the cost of such a material, the fabrication, and the ability to make very large areas of it without impacting the environment are enormous. However, progress has been slow in the last several years, right? So efficiencies, again, approaching 4 or 5% have been demonstrated. But if that number can be doubled or tripled, this becomes really very exciting.
Is there the possibility with rust or metal oxide and the combination of solar cells to make huge surfaces, for example, to make this dream come true that every family has on their house, on the roof, some system? And if they are not harvesting directly the solar energy, that they can convert it into fuel?
Yeah.
Do you think that's a realistic scenario?
Yeah, so I think what's a good way to look at that is to consider what was the situation in photovoltaic technology, the solar cell, the more conventional solar cell, 15 or 20 years ago. And at the time, the cost per watt was viewed as about 100 times what it needs to be. Okay. So if one kind of looked at the situation at that point and said, stop, no point in going further, it's totally unrealistic, we would never be in the situation we are today. 15 or 20 years later, with continued investments, improvements and developments, we are now, we have reached the point where solar cells are competitive, at least in some locations, with the conventional means of generating electricity, which means by burning fossil fuels. So my point is that the situation in terms of the technology that we find these new kinds of solar cells, the ones in which we're trying to convert incident radiation, solar radiation, directly into fuels, is already at a much higher level than photovoltaic cells were back at that point. So we no longer have to improve things by two orders of magnitude or more, but maybe by, let's say, an order of magnitude. Okay, so there's, I think, a great deal of promise. And I would argue that, within the decade, probably a sufficient progress will have been made to demonstrate the feasibility of such cells from a practical standpoint.
Where do you now see the next step or the next challenge to develop a working solar fuel system?
It depends how you define your challenge, okay? Mm-hmm. So I would say if you might call it the Holy Grail, would be to find and optimize a single material to do the complete function. In other words, that is to collect, absorb the solar energy, and directly within a single unit convert that into, let's say, hydrogen gas. Mm-hmm. Okay, that requires that one single material satisfy many criteria simultaneously. And this means, the optical characteristics, its absorption characteristics, its electrical characteristics and properties, its stability within the liquid environment, and its catalytic activity. And this has been the challenge. We can often satisfy one, two, or even three of these things. It's hard to get them all four together. Okay, so I think within that, the biggest challenge is to find a single material which satisfies all those criteria. And there are different approaches that people are taking. I personally am optimistic. I think as a scientist, you have to be optimistic. Otherwise, you should be in another field that you can actually do things. But actually, one can visualize progress, much more rapid progress, by going to hybrid devices. Okay? Mm-hmm. So in other words, in a sense, when you go to a composite system, what you can do is take certain characteristics of one part of the composite, which satisfies certain criteria, and optimize the properties of the other part of the composite to get the other properties. And so right now, for example, there are these compound cells, which use one part, which does the chemistry part primarily, coupled with more conventional photovoltaic cells. Okay, so it might be a silicon device, or it might be one with a larger band gap, like a compound semiconductor. And then it's possible already today to demonstrate feasible operation. I'm not saying that it's necessarily we've satisfied all the cost issues, right? But you can already demonstrate quite high efficiencies. Okay, now it's a question of, can you build these composite or hybrid cells in a cost-effective manner? Okay.
Do you think that we will see another real breakthrough? We will make not necessarily the HZB, but mm-hmm. scientists working on solar fuel, that some really groundbreaking new idea is still to be expected? Or do you think that now we are in the phase where we have to see what we all have understood now, and just to be a bit, drill a little bit mm-hmm. deeper?
Yeah. Well, this is,
revolution always, or evolution?
Yeah. This is an excellent question, and we ask ourselves this all the time. And obviously, we all would love to see a breakthrough, and breakthroughs do come periodically. But what I would say is we shouldn't only depend on that. Okay. So we have to, because the problem is such a huge problem, and the planet now is really under a great deal of duress. We have to do everything we can and move in many parallel directions to try to make progress, whether it's evolutionary or revolutionary. Now, the point is, what is the chances of getting a revolutionary change? I think if you direct people's attention to the problem, which is being done now, right? 10 years ago, the amount of effort and the amount of people focused towards solving the energy problem was small compared to what it is today. If you put enough people on these issues, unexpected things can happen. They can happen at any time, right? But the more resources there are directed in that way, and the more people from different disciplines who are addressing the problem, the more likely is that there will be some kind of synergy between, let's say, physics and chemistry, or electrical engineering and physics. A surprising connection which people might not have made if they were all working independently. So I think the fact that we're exciting a lot of young minds, you know, they're coming back into the science and engineering because they want to do something about the planet's safety, so to speak, right? And they're coming back from going into business or law or something like that.
Is it so, as a professor of MIT, do you experience that young, bright people are not going to finance anymore, but they come to science?
Absolutely. We're seeing a recovery, so to speak, of interest in the sciences and in engineering. And I think it's clear that you know, people will go to where they think they can really have an important impact. And obviously, you know, everyone likes to make a nice living, and there's areas like law and business where that is possible. But I think if you give bright young people a challenge which they think is important to deal with, they will flock to that area. And we're seeing a huge increase in applications, and the application forms themselves. You see the students saying, I want to come to MIT, I want to work in this department, I want to work with you because I'm interested in the environment, I'm interested in solving the energy problem. It's quite clear and quite distinct.
Oh, that's wonderful news. That's really good news. I would love also to ask you a personal question about the retirement issue. You mentioned in your talk, scientists do never retire. why is that so? Why are scientists so keen on continue working, or you personally?
I mean, there's two reasons for that. One is it's an area where you can continue to be stimulated and excited about new ideas, okay? So it's not a question just of the age. It's very, in many fields, you know, once you become familiar with the field and you've done it quite a number of years, it becomes quite routine. The thing that's exciting about science and in engineering problems is it's all the time evolving. And what we're trying to do, as we discussed, is to solve real problems. So there's still plenty of unknowns and plenty of challenges. And particularly for me, being at the university and also interacting with people at institutes like this, is you're automatically thrown in with a lot of young people, and some of their excitement of seeing something new actually is reflected back onto you, right? So, you know, you come in a day, and if you discuss things, you yourself are interested, but if you see other people excited, you know, it's a self-sustaining kind of process. In the U.S., we're fortunate that by law, there no longer is an official retirement age, okay? So that if someone is able and capable and desires to continue working in his area or her area, they can do so. So from my personal standpoint, I could have retired with full benefits several years ago, but I continue to enjoy the stimulation and the ability to interact not only with people at my institute, but worldwide, and this keeps me going.
But you also will give these young people something, I guess. What do you consider is abilities that get better with more experience and with more age? Do you think that there is something which you can do better now than 30 years ago?
Well, for sure. Well, I mean, the point is that you would like to believe that an individual is kind of like a tree. You know, you start out with certain roots and you continue to branch out with time, right? So each of those branches themselves can branch. So with time and with experience, you know, you have had the opportunity to investigate and become aware of and interact with different concepts, okay? So now if you have a new problem at hand, you have that wealth of experience that you could bring. It's not only knowledge about things, but also how to approach a problem, different techniques, and so on. So it's that kind of experience and knowledge. You can help a younger person in navigating how they go through their own career. Okay, so they don't necessarily have to make all the mistakes that someone would have if they didn't have that supervision. So besides just students, I now am very interested in also helping younger colleagues in helping them develop their careers. So in terms of advising them how they might approach their science, their teaching, their other obligations, making that more efficient for them, right? Mm-hmm. And seeing them succeed.
And what result would you really love to see in the next decade? Is there something which you're waiting for and say, oh, that I really would like to witness, and then there would be a change in the field and a new exciting area will start?
Well, obviously, I've had a long interest in the environmental and energy issues, right? And right now, the trend is looking not so positive. I mean, the rate of improvement in our ability to minimize the use of fossil fuels and integrate new technologies doesn't seem to be keeping pace, I should say. It's not keeping pace with the growth of demand in energy, right? Mm-hmm. So what I would love to see from a practical standpoint, from a worldwide standpoint, is that we finally do reach that, you know, that peak, mm-hmm. where our energy demands no longer continue to grow, at least ones which are unsustainable, and that these other technologies finally, promising technologies, which we've been working on for so many decades, finally enter the marketplace and finally start having an impact and changing the direction of the world.